Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 238, and we're going to take a look at what you should be taking a look at when you're trying to look at a used van. How do you know it's a good one? And what if you don't have a choice? We're also going to talk about diesel heaters and their special relationship to power stations. We'll have a product review of something that most people hate, but I love. And a tale from the road involving an old, old song. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thanks for joining me once again. I apologize for being late. I have had a very, very, shall we say, stressful week of dealing with corporate America, and it has reinforced in me the absolute need and desire to just hit the road and stay in my van and never come out if there are other people around. Oh, wow. I used to work in corporate America, and I don't, but I have to deal with them, and I am amazed that a big hole in the earth just doesn't open and swallow up these companies, because, wow. Anyway, I've dealt with it. It's been busy. I'm doing the podcast now. And several of you have sent in requests for stickers and buttons, and I will be getting to those soon. So I have not forgotten about you. Canadian folks, well, you know the deal. I'm sorry. I hope your situation is resolved soon. And a couple of announcements before we get started here. First off, I think I forgot to tell you guys that we're going to Norway. I'm sorry about that. I have a Norway trip taking place on June 21st. It leaves from Southampton, England. It goes up to Lerwick in Scotland, and then to Alesund and Flam in Norway, and then down to Zeebrugge, so you can get to Bruges in Belgium, and then back to Southampton. And I'm going to do some walking tour kind of stuff in London a few days before. And I might tack on a trip to Iceland, looking into that. That if you are interested in joining us on one of these crazy trips, just like the one we did to Danube a while ago, you can visit collegeofcuriosity.com. Yes, that's a website. And you can see there's a join us there, and it will tell you all about the trip. Now, all the pricing in there is old now. I need to update that. But you are more than welcome to join us. And it's a wonderful group of people. We've got over 36 people going now. We've got room for more. So there's that. Now, more van life related, I will be speaking at VanFest USA Liftoff this February 6th through 9th in Melbourne, Florida. You can find out details about that at VanFestUSA.com. This is a large East Coast gathering of folks in nice, sunny Florida in the dead of winter. I know some of you are coming. I look forward to meeting you as well as seeing people I saw there last year. It's a fairly inexpensive event, and heck, if you're living in your van full-time and looking for a warm place to sleep, this is a good one. I think you should come check it out. So again, that's VanFestUSA.com. Now, Nate from our Discord channel asked me to talk about how to pick a used van, and I thought, you know, I haven't covered that in a while. I think that's a good thing. So Nate, this is for you. So folks, buying a used van is fraught, as they say. It's full of pitfalls, and the truth is, buying a new van is too. The difference between buying a used van and a new van is that you don't have a dealership to go to if anything goes wrong. You're kind of on your own with a used van. Now, you can buy a used van with a warranty, etc., but you basically have to trust yourself a lot more in picking out a used van. Caveat emptor is more prevalent in a used van. And vans are not used like cars. You know, any given van could have had a completely different life. You know, maybe this van just hauled around flowers all day. Maybe this van hauled around engine parts or belonged to a welder or something that gave it a totally different life. Maybe this van was a delivery van and did little tiny stops all day long, block to block to block to block to block. Or maybe that van was for long-range transport and drove 4 hours a day. You don't know. I mean, you do know, and well, that's what we're going to talk about. So how do you pick a good used van? This is a topic that's well covered on the internet, and I'm going to start with a good document there and then add my own 2 cents. So I will have a link in the show notes to this, but Consumer Reports, which I think is a fairly good way to look at vehicles if you're doing research, has an article called How to Inspect a Used Car. And I'm just going to go through that article, and then I'm going to add some specific stuff for us, because I think some of that specific stuff actually is important, and I'm kind of surprised they don't cover it. So this is a very long article. They get in detail, and honestly, Consumer Reports, the level of detail here is so much that if you try to follow through with this, you're probably never going to find your van. Quick story, I used to have a 1989 Wander Lodge SP36. This is a massive bus motorhome. And I was living in Virginia, moving to Vermont, and the thing was too heavy for the bridges in Vermont. It weighed 33,000 pounds. This was an absolute beast. So I had to sell it. And so this was back in 2003. I put it up on the internet and stuff, and I got a couple people interested. And this one lovely couple had me meet them up in Baltimore, and they did a test drive, and they really liked it. And I was like, okay, great. And they said, well, we want to do some more research. We'll get back to you. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. You know, and a couple days go by, and I get another call, and it's this other group of folks, and they come by my house, and they give it a test drive, and they're like, this is great. And they buy it, and they're off on the road, and I have my money, and they have the motorhome, and everything's happy. And then a few days later, I get a call back from the first couple saying, hey, we'd like to get an oil test. We'd like to get a sample of oil from the rig and send it into the lab. And I'm like, well, folks, I'm sorry, it's sold. And they were so disappointed because they had fallen in love with the rig and just didn't think anybody else would be interested, but partially because it was pink. Yeah, it was a pink motorhome, but that's another story. And, you know, that's how it is. If you may not have time to go into incredibly fine detail looking at a used van, unfortunately. If you're looking for like a 2014 Econoline 150, you might be able to find 10 of them and pick the best one. But if you're looking for something specific, like you absolutely want a Sprinter 170 from 2016 that has a bolt, you know, the more specific you are, the less choice you have, and the less you're able to go into it in this fine depth. So, just a word to the wise. Let's talk about mileage. Obviously, the two things that matter the most are years and mileage. A newer year and fewer miles is better. That's pretty simple. So, what if you have something that's not that old and has high mileage? That is interesting. Because high mileage typically means highway miles. Highway miles are easier on a vehicle. So, arguably, a, say, 2022 van with a lot of miles would be a better choice than, say, a 2016 van with only a few miles. The 2016 van is older, meaning the rubbers had more time to dry out, things like that. And if it only has a few miles, either it was just sitting around, which is okay, or it was used for these intense, you know, stop, stop, stop kind of travel, which is hard on the vehicle, it's hard on the brakes, it's hard on the starter. There's a lot of parts that's hard on. And a way you can tell, and I will get into this later, is to look at the idle hours versus the number of miles. And we'll talk about that in a bit. So, obviously, you want the lowest miles and the newest you can possibly get. But consider high miles isn't necessarily bad. You have to look at the ratio. Obviously, you want to walk around and look at the body. When you're looking at the body, you're looking for big things like massive dents and stuff. Now, Consumer Reports is like, you know, look for scratches. Honestly, folks, if you're buying a cargo van, scratches are going to be the least of your concern, okay? I don't think that's a big deal. But make sure the body's in good shape and look for mismatched panels. For example, the front fenders. If one front fender is a little closer to the door than the other front fender, that's a sign that it's been in a front-end accident. You can also crawl under the vehicle and look to see if there's anything spray-painted that shouldn't be. For example, all the body panels should be one color, and the frame should not be any, there should be no paint on the frame. If you see any, like, you have a white van and there's white spray on the frame, that means some work has been done. You can also look for what are called clamp marks underneath the van. These are very obvious marks that, imagine someone grabbing the bottom of the van with a large pair of pliers. Well, that's what this looks like, and it's almost what it is. If the body's been straightened at all, the auto body companies will attach these massive clamps and literally pull the body back into shape, and that leaves marks. So you want to look for that. Now, if you think it's been in a crash, that isn't necessarily the end of the world, but at that point, you absolutely should consider getting a Carfax. Now, an individual Carfax, I think, costs $39, and you might think, well, geez, that's a lot, but it's a lot less than buying the wrong vehicle, and it's completely fair to go to the owner and say, look, I'm really interested in this vehicle. I'm a little concerned about a few things. Can you get me a Carfax? And you can negotiate that. I think all sellers should get a Carfax whenever they sell the van personally, because they can use that same Carfax over and over and over again. For everybody who's interested in the van, they can use the same Carfax. And it gives them a lot of credibility. They can say, here, look, no accidents, you know? So definitely check for a Carfax on almost always, and certainly if there's any kind of thing that looks a little suspicious. Look at the tires. Make sure the tires are good. I mean, you obviously want to make sure it has good tires, but also look at the wear. If the tire wear is uneven, that's indicative of something. For example, if the inside of the tires are worn more than the outside, that can indicate either really aggressive driving, or the toe-in or camber are wrong, or something like that. There may need to be at least an adjustment, and that can also mean there was an accident. Worse is when the tire wear in the back is uneven, because the back, obviously those wheels, unless you have a four-wheel steering van, which I've never heard of, those wheels don't move. They're hard to adjust. I know in my NV200, it was literally impossible to adjust anything on the rear wheels. So if there's something wrong back there, that's a little scary. Looking up a history of ownership, which is also in the Carfax, is good. If it's a 2022 van, it's had 6 owners, that's a big red flag. Something's up there. There's something that you have to worry about. Now, as far as the engine, which, you know, I think what most people are concerned about, unless you're a mechanic, there's only so much you can do. You know, you can pop the hood, you can look at it, you can look to see if there's anything flying out, you can check for leaks. That's about it. You know, you can look at the belts and make sure they look like they're in good shape. You can watch some YouTube videos on how to do this and get a little bit more information. But there's a lot of stuff that can be wrong with an engine that only a mechanic is going to detect. So if you are seriously interested about a van and it's an expensive van, it is worth spending a few $100 to have a mechanic look it over. You pick the mechanic, not them. Find a local mechanic. Better not to be a dealership. Better be like Joe's Garage down the street. Have them go over it with a fine-tooth comb and see what they can find. And they're motivated to find stuff because that means potentially more work for them. So that is a good thing. But while we're talking about the engine, there's something that the Consumer Reports article doesn't mention that I think is an excellent thing to do, and it's exactly what I did, is buy an OBD2 port reader. We've talked about this a lot. There's a port under all modern cars' dashboards that you can plug a computer into, and it'll tell you all the codes. And you can also do this for free at any auto parts store. You can bring the vehicle in and they'll scan it for free. But I recommend you buy one. They're not that expensive. You can get a really cheap one at Harbor Freight that would work fine for this purpose. But go ahead and spend $75 or so on one. This is something, if you're doing van life and you're working on vehicles a lot, you're going to use time and time again. And boy, when that check engine light comes on, it's really nice to be able to scan the code and then see, oh God, what's this? My gas cap's loose, you know? It's just nice. Or it'll say, your engine's about to explode. Yeah, that can happen too. So get one of those. And then when you test drive the vehicle, go ahead and plug it in under the dashboard. You can Google this if you don't know what I'm talking about, but there's pictures there. And then scan all codes. Now there's two results that you're going to get. You're either going to get some codes, which you can then Google and figure out what they are. Or in some cases, you'll get no codes. And no codes can be just as bad as some codes, because it's possible to clear these codes. However, when you clear the codes, the scanner knows that, and it's going to come up with a not ready message. And what that means is the code has been cleared and the vehicle hasn't been run long enough to establish that those codes aren't coming back. So you want to make sure that the codes are acceptable and that it says ready. Read your owner's manual if you need to, but that's very important. And this is where the idle hours come in. One of the things you can read is the idle hours of a vehicle. Now, this varies a lot from vehicle to vehicle, and on some vehicles, it's not reliable. For example, my Ram 1500, for some reason, that setting gets reset sometimes. And I don't know how, apparently nobody does. But, especially if you're buying like a diesel Sprinter, the idle hours, how many hours the vehicle has been sitting doing nothing, matters. As an estimate, every hour of idling is worth 30 miles of driving. So every 100 hours of idle is worth 300 miles. Idling is bad for engines sometimes. It depends on the engine and such. It's not recommended that you idle your engines anymore, even with diesels if they're modern, because modern diesels are not the same as the older diesels, which could just idle forever. So you can check idle hours with this scanner and then compare them to the mileage. A vehicle with relatively low mileage and relatively high idle hours sat around a lot. Ambulances typically will have that ratio, for example. Also, another thing, and this is mentioned in the article, but this is a more serious thing than they make it, is odor. If you get into the van and it has a strong smell of any kind, that's a red flag. I bought my truck at CarMax, Ram 1500 2019. I got in, and there was one of those trees hanging in it. You know, those stinky trees? Man, horrible. Like, they really just filled this thing with scent. And I'm like, okay, this will go away in a while. And stupidly, I didn't think, why did they fill it with scent? Well, now I've had the vehicle for 10 months, and I notice that sometimes on really hot days when I open the door, it smells like smoke in there. Yeah, I bought a smoker's truck. I had no idea that I was doing that. There's nothing, no burn holes in there. There's no ashes. The inside is actually pretty clean. But yeah, cigarette smoke is forever. It gets in all the vents and everything, and eventually you're going to get a whiff of it. So also smells musty. That might mean that the condensate line for the air conditioner is clogged. And if you smell antifreeze, that means there might be a leak in the heater core. So just know any strong odor needs to be explained, and that could be a deal breaker right there, because you're going to be driving around with that smell forever and you might not be able to handle it. Lastly, a thing that I think is more important than engine problems is rust. Engine problems can be fixed. You can replace the whole engine and have a perfectly good van. Rust is a whole other thing. Rust is like car cancer. And you can treat it, and sometimes you can stop it, but sometimes you can't. And anybody who owns an Econoline, an old Econoline, knows what I'm talking about. It's insidious. You think everything's fine, and then one day you drop a quarter on the floor, and you're looking around for it, and you see this little rusty stuff, and then you pick up the carpet, and the whole bottom of the van is gone. Rust is worse to me than engine problems, because engine problems can be fixed. You can fix rust, but the fix is in quotes. It almost always comes back, and it involves welding and finding fabricated parts. And in a lot of times, what they have to do is find an old van that isn't rusted in that area, cut out the piece of the old van, and then weld it back into your van. So, yeah, rust, I think, is my biggest thing to be afraid of. Now, I'm going to stop here because this is getting too long. Obviously, there's more and more and more you can look at. But bottom line is, watch a few YouTube videos about how to properly vet a vehicle. And sadly, I have to say that no matter how much you vet the vehicle, you could still get a bad vehicle. So I don't know what you do with that information, but it's true. Don't beat yourself up if you buy a vehicle that has problems and you didn't catch them. But know that that could happen, and plan for it. Thanks to everyone who has supported this podcast at buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. Every time you buy me a gallon of diesel, it pushes those ads off further into the future. And they're pretty far in the future right now. So thank you very much. We all enjoy an ad-free podcast, and I would love to keep this one that way. Again, that's buymeacoffee.com/builttogo. Special thanks to all of you who donate every single month. I really appreciate it. Tech Talk. Oh, so, it's cold out. It was 7 degrees when I woke up this morning, and in some parts of Chicago it was 4 degrees. That's Fahrenheit, folks. That's cold. And I was starting to think about my upcoming build that I hope to do in the back of my truck. I'm hoping to do a no build in some kind of a cap in the back of my truck, thinking about different ways to do that. And I like diesel heaters, but it's hard to do a diesel heater in a no build because, well, you've got this exhaust hose to deal with that pretty much needs to be sent through the body of your vehicle. And that means drilling a hole in the body of your vehicle, and that's not a no build. But it's getting a little easier. They're making more and more different configurations of all-in-one diesel heaters. You still need to find a place to put the exhaust hose, but it's getting easier. But in doing this research, I learned something that I think needs to be mentioned if you're planning out a build with a diesel heater and you're using a power station. Power stations have 12 volts out, almost always. It's usually a cigarette lighter plug. Sometimes they'll have barrel connectors too. But just like the cigarette lighter in your car, they tend to be limited to 10 amps. So in your car, if you plug in something that's more than 10 amps into your cigarette lighter plug, it will pop a fuse. You got to replace the fuse. Okay. In power stations, it trips a circuit breaker that's inside. It basically shuts off the power station. And diesel heaters can draw more than 10 amps when they start up. And that's a problem. What's happened to some folks is they'll buy an all-in-one diesel heater and they'll buy a beefy power station. This happens to my Explorer 1500, my Jackery, which is a pretty heavy, beefy power station. And it will shut off and they can't get heat. So, what do you do? First off, let's explain why this is happening. I first encountered this when I was trying to run a water pump off of a power station. I was like, well, this runs off my 12-volt battery in the car. Why won't it run off this power station? They're both 12 volts. And that's where I made my mistake. I learned that these power stations are optimized for giving out 110 volts AC. Well, if you're optimizing for that, then you don't want a 12-volt battery. You want as much voltage battery as you can get. And a lot of these power stations have 24-volt batteries in them. Now, there's no 24-volt connection on it. You can't get 24 volts out of it. But that's what's actually inside it. And that 24 volts feeds a 24-volt to 110-volt inverter. And that's what it's optimized for. For example, you'll notice there's usually three places to plug in a normal outlet, and then there's only one place for 12 volts. So because of this, you have to knock down 24 volts to 12 volts to get that cigarette lighter plug to work. And because all the wiring in this thing is for 24 volts, and remember, higher voltage means smaller wires. Yeah, it's the amps that make wires bigger. Higher volts, lower amps, smaller wires. Well, because those smaller wires are in there, they limit the 12 volts, which they are converting, to 10 amps. And that's the problem. They are converting 24 volts to 12 volts. That's why you can't get native 12 volts out of it, because there's no 12-volt battery in there. I have perhaps gotten too specific here, but point is, you can still use one of these portable, in quotes, diesel heaters with a power station, also called a solar generator. But boy, do I hate that term. And the answer is, you buy one that has a 110-volt plug. And these are getting more and more common. Let me explain. It used to be in the days you'd buy a 12-volt diesel heater, whether it was a Vivor or an Ebispatcher or whatever. You would just wire it directly into the battery with the proper fuses and stuff, and that was it. Now with these portable ones, they've realized that people want to use them in sheds and things like that, in places where there's 110 volts, but no 12 volts. So they come with a 110 volt plug. You just plug it into the wall and that's the power for the unit. Well, that plug actually goes to a brick, much like the thing you'd find on a refrigerator, if you have a 12 volt compressor refrigerator, and that goes into the power station, and it's more than 10 amps. I think it's 15 amps. So you can plug a 110-volt plug from a diesel heater into that portion of your power station, and it will work. Don't use the 12-volt part. Use the 110-volt part. Now, in my brain, I am screaming about the inefficiencies of 24 volts DC being converted to 110-volt AC being then converted to 12 volts DC. Drives me crazy. But the power station is actually more optimized to do that. So it works. I haven't tested it myself yet, but from all the reports I've seen, this works, and you can use your diesel heater with your power station. And that solves almost all your problems. The last, probably biggest problem with these things is how you're going to run the exhaust. And I haven't figured out what I'm going to do with that, but I will figure it out. At least now you only have one problem. So, if you woke up really cold this morning because your diesel heater wouldn't start off of your power station, see if you can find the 110-volt solution or just get another one. Because it's not worth it to fight with these things. If it's not working, spend another $120 and get a new one that fits, because it's going to make your life a lot easier. Product review. I have been asked to talk about some of the strange foods I've eaten as I've traveled around, and one of these is interesting because I will say it. I'm going to say the name of this thing. More than half of the audience is going to be like, "A what?" And a very specific few of you are going to be like, "Oh, yeah, mate." And that's because I'm going to talk about musk sticks. To be clear, musk sticks have nothing to do with our current political landscape. Musk sticks, or musk lollies as they're sometimes called, are an Australian treat that have a flavor that is described as musk, which is a scent from the anal glands of a specific species of deer, but actually is more akin to perfume or maybe shaving cream. So these are pink sticks. If you know what a Twizzler is, okay, imagine a Twizzler, and it's pink. And it's not made out of licorice, it's actually technically fondant. But it's more cohesive than that. It's not like it just came out of a tube. You can hold it and wave it around. And you just eat it. You just chew on it, you bite off a piece, and it gives you this incredibly intense flavor of chemically perfume. Most people who try these, at least from the United States, think they're the most disgusting thing ever. They're listed on a lot of disgusting food lists. But I love them. In fact, I like all the musk-flavored stuff. I had musk-flavored gum in South Africa. Lifesavers makes a musk-flavored Lifesaver. I like it. It's a flavor I like. Yeah, I'm a little weird. But musk sticks, I'll have a link in the show notes. You can order them from Amazon if you're curious about them. I recently traveled Europe with a friend of mine from Australia who was nice enough to bring a bag for us all to try, and I got to take it home afterwards. Thank you, Andrew. They're all gone now, by the way. Musk sticks. If you have not encountered these, at least try it, just to have the experience, because you will either find a brand new treat, or you will find a new way to wonder at the world and why people are the way they are. Tales from the Road. So I can tell this story now, and it will make sense to more people than it used to make sense to, because time has moved on. Way back in the dark days, no, it wasn't that dark. This was about 2008. I was dating a woman in Vermont, and so I think it was our second date. And we met downtown in Burlington, down in the Church Street area, because that's where you go when you're in Burlington. And she said, "Oh, wait a minute. I have to get something out of my trunk." And I was like, "Okay." And so we go to the back of her car, and she opens the trunk, and there in the trunk is a cake. A beautiful cake. It's like professionally decorated cake, like a $50 cake. It's really nice. And she said, "I got this at work today, and I don't know what to do with it." And I'm like, "Well, we don't have any way to eat it. I don't want to take it home. I live alone. You know, it's this massive cake. What can we do with it?" Well, as it turned out, we were near a park in Burlington that homeless people spent time in. And we were like, "Well, what the heck?" So we took the cake over to the park and put it on a table and just left it there. And heck, we thought, you know, I mean, we didn't have any forks and stuff, and it kind of felt bad not to just, like, put a candle in it and say, "Hey, enjoy," and give everybody forks and knives and stuff. We just didn't have that, and we were late for a dinner appointment. So we left it there, and we figured folks would find it if they wanted it. And if they didn't, you know, maybe the squirrels would get it. I don't know. In retrospect, this may not have been the best idea, but it's what we came up with at the time. So off we go to dinner, have a lovely dinner. I think we're at the Daily Planet, actually. And then it starts to rain. It's pouring out. And I'm like, oh no, it's raining. And she's like, "Yeah." And I'm like, "But we left a cake out in the park. We left a cake out in the rain in the park. And I'm not sure if I can take it. And we'll never have that recipe again." And you didn't know what I was talking about. Hopefully some of you know what I'm talking about. If you don't, please investigate MacArthur Park. Just Google MacArthur Park. That's all I'm asking. And you will get to see another reason why you can ask yourself why people are the way they are. And to answer the question, yeah, no one had eaten the cake. It was out there in the rain with all the frosting melting, and we picked up through the trash. A place to visit. This is a place that has been recently added to my bucket list because I just found out about it. And do not delay. If this is a place you want to see, I think this is the kind of place that's going to disappear in a few years. So definitely go there right now. It's 1 hour south of Phoenix, Arizona, in Maricopa. And it is called the Dwarf Car Museum. Yes, it is a museum of dwarf cars. Now, before you assume that dwarf cars are actually cars for little people, they are not. They are not. In fact, dwarf cars are a special car lover's thing where you take a production car and then just shrink it down. And I don't mean like a miniature car. I mean like it's big enough that it's a car, but it's a lot smaller than the car it started with. It's kind of a crazy thing. So let's back up here. This guy named Ernie Adams started making these cars 40, 50 years ago. And he would literally take like a modern car and just make it smaller, like maybe half the size. So it's not like a model or anything like that. It's just a perfectly produced copy of the car, just like half the size. And he's built a whole bunch of these, and they're very cute, but also very odd. And he put them on display. I mean, what else do you do, right? So he created his own little museum in Maricopa, Arizona. And for the low, low price of $5, you can go visit these things and see them. And heck, why not? You know, this is the kind of really interesting, unique thing that you should be seeing. And I don't think this is going to be around all that much longer because Ernie's not a young man. Ernie might be tired of this and he might sell off his collection. So if you're in the Phoenix, Arizona area, maybe staying at the casino they have down there, the Action Harrah's, this would be a great place to just spend a little while and see something you didn't even know existed. Of course, I'll have a link in the show notes. It's dwarfcarmuseum.com. But I've never even heard of these things, and I'm fascinated by it. So the next time I'm in Phoenix, I am definitely going to check this place out. It's $5. Ernie prefers cash. And I highly recommend you make sure they're open before you go. All the information's on the website. And a lot of times it looks like you just call up Ernie and say, "Hey, Ernie, I want to come see your stuff." And then he'll just let you in. It looks like a lot of fun. And you know what? We deserve to have a lot of fun, so go check it out. Resource recommendation. I was introduced to this thing in the Discord channel, one of the Discord channels I haunt, and, well, I'm just going to tell you about this. This is not really a recommendation as so much as to make you aware of, because I have reservations, but this is a new van life app. And I know there's been a ton of van life apps. People have been trying to make a walk-in-the-community van life kind of an app for a long time. None of them have really taken off. And I think mostly because they get too quickly into the money grab. You know, they're like, oh, come try out this app. And then for $10 a month, and you see the problem. This right now is completely free. And what it is, it's an app where you can gather a bunch of friends in the app. And then you can basically share locations and future plans. And the app would be ideal for a group of people who are traveling the road together loosely. Like, let's say you have 20 or so trusted friends. Sometimes you travel together, sometimes you don't. But you trust them enough that you're okay letting them know where you are. Using this app, they can simply look up where you are. And then if they're nearby, they can come meet with you or whatever. Or if you're throwing some kind of a van life event, like you're having a big gathering out in BLM land some night and you're going to have a campfire or whatever, be sure it's legal, and you want people to come, you can create a thing called a beacon that a lot of people can see, and you can set the settings on this, and then that beacon will show up on the map, and then anybody around will know that they're welcome to come because somebody put a beacon there. It's not complete. I feel like they're still fleshing the app out. But I have to say, I kind of like it. You can also put your route in there. Like, you can put your future plans. Like, if you know you're going to be doing Natchez Trace and where you're going to stop, you can mark all that in there and people can follow along. Now, I know some of you listening to this are horrified. Like, holy cow, the privacy implications. And yeah, I agree. If you're somebody who's overly concerned about privacy, this is probably not the app for you. This is another app that's going to be tracking where you are and then broadcasting it. Now, if all their security is in place, only your friends should be able to see it, but you know how that goes. So, not for the security-minded folks. And because of that, I think a lot of solo female travelers are going to stay away from this app because, you know, I don't have to say it, so I won't. For me, I'm going to try it out. I've embraced it. I've put my location on there. I have put a beacon up for VanFest USA, which I talked about earlier, and I have shown my future plans on there. And I figure if something bad happens, heck, it's content. I'll tell you about it on the podcast. You know what? I'm going to give them a chance, and if you want to check it out, it's the Crossroads app. Unfortunately, the name Crossroads is taken by a whole bunch of different things. So I'll have a link in the show notes to the actual app links. But if you look in your app store, maybe type in Crossroads Van Life or something like that, and it should come up. I've got some reservations. I can see that my friend Lily right now is somewhere between Bloomington and Springfield, Illinois. I assume Lily is okay with me knowing that because she's broadcasting that, so that's fine. And if I had a group of people and I was traveling around with, it would be fun to say, oh, look, you know, Jack's over in Devil's Tower today. That's kind of cool, you know, that kind of a thing. So anyway, check it out if you'd like, the Crossroads app, yet another van life community app. And boy, it would be nice if one of these finally actually caught on. Well, folks, thanks very much for listening to me once again. I appreciate your patience. You may have noticed a little tiny bit of new music. That is also from Simon Wagg, who has done all of our music. Thank you, Simon. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am Jeff at builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And the socials that I'm doing are found at the top of the page at builttogo.com. Until next week, remember the words of Pietro Aretino, who said, "Let us love winter, for it is the spring of genius."